Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Kevalramani, and today I have with me my colleague Suyash Desai, and we're going to be talking about a new research output that we've come out with, which is a document looking at China's military reforms. Xi Jinping launched his reforms in late 2015, early 2016, and since then there's been lots of activity that's happened, and what we decided to do was we decided to examine it within a proper framework and try and look at whether these reforms have actually furthered China's national security based on objectives that they've sort of set up. Suyash, can you tell me what exactly was the rationale sort of when we started looking at this? What were the sort of first thoughts of, you know, why this is important, right? You know, how did you sort of think of how do we go about this?
So, Manoj, we are following China for past some time. We realized that over the past 5-6 years, there have been multiple reforms happening in China. Military modernization is also happening in China, and a lot of money has gone in. But there is a lot of opacity surrounding what is actually happening. The information is not really coming out. It does have a national security implication for states around India and the world. So we thought that it is important to look what is happening in China in their national security and military domain, and to analyze whether they are really walking on the track to achieve their national security objectives. The things that they are claiming, whether they are really walking the talk or just it is words.
Yeah, whether it's just, you know, something that you're doing in terms of, you know, propaganda value.
Yes.
I mean, or there could also be a mix of it, right? You know, you sort of, General Menon likes to say this, right? The Chinese tend to over sort of emphasize everything that they do because it has a certain propaganda and deterrent value, and it might not be a real measure of the actual capacity of the state, but you actually publicize far greater. And we've seen that with Xi Jinping also, right? Lots more military parades, lots more naval drills, Xi Jinping dressed in fatigues and sort of moving around. The idea that you're projecting this power, and the idea therefore for us was that if you're projecting this power, let's start looking at what exactly is the capacity that you've developed based on these reforms. So how did sort of you go about, because you're the person who started this process and started this project, how did you go about looking at what these reforms are? So how did you classify that?
We can divide it into three parts: primary document, secondary document, speeches. Speeches can also be a part of primary document. So first, primary document, we have looked at many things stated by the government and the party. So defense white papers across last few years, speeches of Xi, what their websites and their newspapers are talking about on military reforms, on military developments. Second, there are multiple scholars studying Chinese national security, PLA, India's national security, security around East Asia. We've looked at those documents. We've also looked at research done by multiple think tanks and academics across the world. And then finally, we have narrowed it down to Xi's and CMC's select speeches, which are talking about their objectives. And then a compilation of all this together allows us to analyze what they are doing and how they are doing it.
So if I was to sort of summarize that, essentially what we've done is that we started with essentially the work for that other people have done to look at how do you frame something like this, how do you frame an assessment like this, and then started to look at, well, exactly what is the Chinese leadership talking about when it talks about national security, what are their objectives, and how do they see the world around them, and also their perspectives of their own strengths and weaknesses in terms of their armed forces. And that is evident from the speeches, like you said, from the defense white papers, which tend to, like at least the 2019 defense white paper gave quite a candid admission when it said something to the effect of the PLA still lags behind other militaries around the world quite significantly. And it talks about also things like, you know, informatization, intelligentization and things like that.
Also 2015 white paper, which says that its interests are overseas and it has to go from green water to blue water.
So the interesting thing in that is that, you know, while there is a lot of opacity and, you know, one has to sort of parse through news reports like you did, through English language and Chinese language news reports, there's also lots of information that the Chinese tend to state. It's not like they don't necessarily communicate. I mean, it's very different from, say, the North Koreans. The Chinese tend to communicate exactly their view of the world. And you do reading between the lines. And you sort of then do the grind work of scanning through different news reports to look at which vessel, which tank, and so on and so forth, and the details of each equipment. And that is the grunt work that one needs to do. But what's also sort of helped is things like, you know, military balance, CIPRI, the work that those guys do, which give you a framework of how to look at things, gives you sort of data points to look at, and that helps, right?
So year after year, military balance has come out with the data of force development, force capacity that every country has. So it was very useful to look at Chinese capacities over the years. So we have sort of analyzed military balance from 2014 to 2019. So 2020 just came out last month, but our threshold was 2019, and it is a lot of work. They have a lot of data points. So we had to open multiple military balance and look what has changed in every military balance. So there's a lot of data work.
You have to sort of compare and contrast data over a period of time to try and come up with an assessment which is original, which sort of provides a different perspective.
Yes.
And obviously, this is all about looking at capacity as opposed to looking at necessarily how force can and will be used, because those are political decisions. And we'll come to that sort of stuff later.
Yes, yes.
But okay. So
But military balance or CIPRI or RAND, they just give data points.
Yeah.
So analysis is ours. So based on those data points, we have to figure out whether this has happened or this is really what they are stating and this is leading to what they are stating.
Okay. So let's get into what are the kinds of reforms that we looked at. I mean, some of these are fairly well known, so I'm not going to go into details into those. But things like, you know, Xi Jinping announced he removed the old military region system. He ended that and he crafted 5 theater commands. Theater commands were essentially, where now force structures would sort of intermingle and it would break down service hierarchies in some ways, and it would allow for joint operations and things like that, because you saw your threats evolving from how they were in the past. And now China has 5 theater commands. Each theater command has a geographic responsibility, and there's a different theater commander. There was also new forces created. So there was a rocket force, there was a joint logistics support force, there was the special SSF, the strategic support forces, and each of them had a different sort of then frame of reference in terms of what their objective was. For example, the strategic force was supposed to look at, or is supposed to look at, space, electromagnetic and cyber warfare and things like that.
Also, all the forces were brought on the same pedestal. So yeah. Army, Navy and Air Force.
Yeah, so these guys were brought on the same pedestal, and that was important because the ground force is traditionally dominated. And I mean, in many ways, China has also had that sort of blinker like India, right? Where, you know, the continental sort of domain, security domain dominates so much that you don't look at the sort of maritime domain. And this was a shift in that. You were looking at not just the maritime domain, but you were also looking at newer areas of threats, which is where space and cyber and all that comes into play. So that was another bit of the very well-known set of reforms that he announced.
Paramilitary forces.
The paramilitary. So that sort of would come under the nature of the Central Military Commission. So for anybody who's unaware of how the Chinese national security structure is sort of it's structured, at the top of it sits, operationally at the top of everything sits the Central Military Commission. It's the top bureaucratic body which Xi Jinping is the chairman of. And before 2017, there were about 11 people in that, 11 people who were part of that military commission. And now there are 7. And most of them close confidants of Xi. And even some of the generals in there have sort of shifted. It's not that the ground forces are now dominating. And the last point here, which I remember that we had talked about, was that you've got a discipline inspection commission guy over there. And that's sort of part of the broader anti-corruption campaign, which also entails making sure that politically the forces align to Xi. So those are the sort of well-known things. But there's lots more that's happened. And sort of, can you tell us what are the sort of other areas that we've looked at, and what are the interesting pieces which are not necessarily very well known publicly?
So we've also looked at changes that has happened in the force structure. So when Xi Jinping announced his military reforms, the first reform that he highlighted was reduction of PLA personnel. He highlighted that he would be reducing 3 lakh military personnel. And that has really happened. By 2018, he had reduced number of PLA.
300,000
military personnel.
Yeah.
A major cut has been bared by ground forces, so the army. There has been a minor cut in Air Force, and the number of people, personnel, that is the armed personnel, has increased in Navy.
Okay.
So this points that there is a strategic change in the approach. As you have pointed out, India and China are traditionally looking at ground, but the ground forces are, they are cutting down their ground forces and looking at Air Force and Navy and then strategic support force. This points that they are looking overseas, they are looking...
And it also tells you that there is a shift happening from the point of view of forces which are manpower intensive to forces which are more firepower intensive. I mean, it comes back to mind that, you know, this when you had that parade in October, one of the National Day parade floats was the Science Commission.
Yes.
And the idea that you wanted to highlight scientific and scientific development, innovation as part of the broader military modernization is something which is important. It sort of signals that you're moving towards greater firepower intensity.
So also, okay. One of the float, if I'm not wrong, was SSF.
So yes. So that's a new force, so that's bound to be there. But from the point of view of, you didn't need to have that signaling value of innovation, and that's what you've signaled. But beyond the sort of reduction of forces, firstly, where did we get this data from for reduction of forces?
So this reduction of forces data is based on military balance 2015 to 2019.
Okay, so they've essentially put out their data, which tells you that, you know, that essentially the cuts have come in the ground forces. And yes, there have been quite a steep cut in the ground forces, more than 300,000, right?
Yes. So this is an interesting data point. By the end of 2018, for the first time since 1949, the army's share in the PLA dropped below 50%.
Okay.
So it was 71% back then. Okay, I have to make these things clear. This is not the first time that a force cut has happened, but this is significant because the number of people cut is great. And okay, especially army has been targeted.
Okay, so we've seen a reduction in the ground forces, which brings their total number of personnel in terms of the total armed forces personnel down to below 50%.
And for the first time since 1949.
For the first time since the formation of the People's Republic of China. What else? What else has happened apart from reduction of forces?
There has been a change in the force structure. Initially, there were seven line of commands operating for origination and dissemination of idea or a command. Now, they have reduced it to six. So, at the top of it is the theater command. And theater command is responsible for every other structure. So, the idea or a operational directive comes from the theater command. And it is, the flow of information has been made easy. And this has happened in Army and Air Force. They have not touched Navy. Only one thing that happened in Navy is the commissioning of Marine Corps, which is their expeditionary forces.
Okay, so they've expanded in terms of the commissioning of the Marine Corps, and they're expanding on that because they feel that there would be greater amphibious warfare capacity that would be required for more reasons than one.
Yes.
It would be also beyond necessarily what's happening in Taiwan or the East China Sea or the South China Sea, but also assuming that you've got a base in Djibouti, yeah, and there are other operations that are
required.
So
part of Marine Corps is deployed in Djibouti.
Okay, so that's one thing also that Xi Jinping sort of set up, right? That base in Djibouti,
yes,
which was set up. So there's been a reduction in the levels of bureaucracy within a particular force.
Yes.
So that information can be communicated easily. And also you can have rationalized forces for better activity, better operationalization. And you've also created an environment wherein, in case of wartime, the theater command takes charge of the force structure within it. In case of peacetime, it's the individual service. So in case it's peacetime, it's the administrative work in all lies with, say, the ground forces headquarters, the Air Force headquarters. But in case of wartime, it's actually the theater command which takes charge of everything in terms of the entire force that's available within its capacity.
So the division is such that the administrative work is with the CMC now. Forces are responsible for force development, capacity development. And theater commands are responsible for operational wartime role.
Okay, so that's the division. Administratively, yeah, it's within the CMC.
Yes.
Force development goes to individual forces.
Surfaces.
So the Air Force can then decide what kinds of jets it wants. Naval headquarters will decide what kind of vessels it wants to invest in. The ground forces headquarters will decide on what kinds of equipment it wants to develop or what kind of force structure it wants to maintain. But the theater command essentially becomes a client for these individual forces, and because they supply the force individuals to them, right?
Yeah.
And the theater command can say that, okay, this is the kind of force structure that we want, so many personnel, these kinds of vessels and this, that, and it's the job of the individual service headquarters to then
to
fulfill those.
It, yeah. And provide. In case of war, theater command, so in hierarchy, the service headquarters is over theater command, but in case of war, theater command is the chief.
Theater.
So obviously there is CMC up there,
yeah,
but theater command, the importance to theater command is more.
Okay.
And they call the shots.
Okay,
under so, keeping CMC in loop, of course.
Okay, so that's the essential switch that happened, essentially to make it far more responsive.
Yes.
And to make joint action far more potent.
Yes.
Okay. What else has happened?
There has been change in the financial allocation.
Okay.
So, we have seen that the capital expenditure has gone up since 2012. And it has crossed 40% since 2014-15 when she started the reforms.
So, as part of China's overall defense budget, I mean, do we know how the defense budget is divided?
Yes. So, it is divided in three parts. Mm. One is the personal expense. One is training and sustainment. And third one is the capital expenditure.
And how do we get this breakup? Because the Chinese don't necessarily put out a breakup like, say, we in India do put out a breakup. How did we get to this breakup?
There are three ways of getting this breakup. One is the data given by Chinese defense white paper itself, which is the most modest data. Second is by CIPRI, and third is by RAND, RAND Corporation. So we have gone with the data of, given by Chinese government state itself. Yeah. And we are sure that this data can vary. This can go up as claimed by CIPRI and RAND. We have believed on the figures given by Chinese defense.
Okay, so our assumption is that what the Chinese are saying, let's take that at face value.
Yes.
And you know, one can disagree or agree with it in terms of the actual data, actual number of figures. So you might not want to agree that the Chinese defense budget is about $180 billion. You might assume that it is 270, but at least we can take from the data points that, okay, even if it may be 250 or whatever, 270, and the Chinese are saying that it's 175 or 180 billion, the trend of how much is being spent on the equipment, how much is being spent on personnel, how much is being spent on sustenance would largely be same in terms of percentages.
Given by all three.
Given by all three. So what we found, that equipment expenditure till 2017...
From 2014-2015 has gone up.
Has gone up.
Till 2017.
And it's above 40% of the total budget.
It's above 40%, yes.
Okay, which is an interesting thing, right? Given that in India, we've been having this conversation of the fact that our salaries and pensions bill will now come 60 plus percentage of our entire defense budget. And here you've got a case where 40% of the Chinese defense spending is going on new equipment. So what are the kind of things that they are building that tell us that there is a change in any of their objectives?
So we have studied multiple examples, but I'll just give out one or two examples in this podcast. One is the cruiser. In US, it is called cruiser. In other countries, it is called destroyer. It is the second largest ship after aircraft carriers. Hmm. China states wants to manufacture 8 cruisers, that is type 055 cruisers. A cost of one cruiser is around 852 to 900 million US dollars. Hmm. Okay, so I have to give one clarification. Most of these figures were available in Chinese currencies. We have converted it into US dollars. So I'm giving US dollars out.
Okay.
So 900 million US dollars. From the first time an announcement was made publicly that we want to commission, we as in China wants to commission a cruiser, till the time the first cruiser came out, it took 3 years. Hmm. So, and this is from 2014 to 2016. So announcement was made in 2014. The first cruiser came out in 2016.
Came out meaning it got commissioned finally.
Not in the waters. The test trial runs were happening.
Okay, trial runs.
Manufactured.
Began. Okay.
Yeah, in 2016. So if we divide it into 3 years, the total amount of money that is taken for the building of cruiser, it's 300 million per year.
Okay.
For one cruiser.
Yeah.
So out of the capital expenditures of 50, 60 and 60 billion over 3 years, billion dollars over 3 years, 300 million was utilized for one type 055 cruiser. Hmm. They are planning to make 8 over X number of period. We don't know how many period.
Yeah.
Similarly, they have made, cruiser is just one example. China is the biggest deployable navy in the world. There are cruisers, destroyers, aircraft carriers, submarines, different types of submarines and whatnot. So you can see that a lot of money has gone into modernization of their navy.
Yeah.
Similarly, in aircraft, similar instances can be found out in aircraft. We have given an example in the paper of G20 aircraft. You can go to the paper and look at it.
So let me summarize this. So essentially what we are saying is that equipment spending has gone up to be about 40% of the defense budget.
Yes.
Okay. So as of 2017, based on whatever the defense budget was, then we estimated that about $60 billion was spent on equipment, or at least earmarked for equipment. Now, if you take that $60 billion and put it aside, they are doing multiple things with that $60 billion to build multiple different things. But if you look at just from a naval point of view, the many, many ships and submarines that they are building, they want to build 8 destroyers over X number of years.
Mm-hmm.
One building of one destroyer will take 3 years. Each year, that destroyer would cost $300 million.
Mm-hmm.
So over a period of 3 years, it will cost approximately $1 billion. So over a period of 3 years, $1 billion is spent on one destroyer. So if in that 1 year you've commissioned two destroyers, two submarines, many more smaller frigates, many more other things,
LPDs.
You're spending a very large amount of money on naval development, given the nature of the expense of these ships. And also what is then visible, right? So we have not seen too many new things that have been developed when it comes to the ground forces. There's a light tank that I know you mentioned. But there is not significantly too much new that's been put out there. Whereas in terms of the Navy, we've seen lots of new ships commissioned. We've also seen, for example, in the same period, we've also seen an aircraft carrier now come out. So more money is being spent in that direction. And just the weight of how capital intensive these projects are tells you that where the money is going for this new equipment. So that tells you a little bit about what their priorities are. Because why would you want to build a destroyer if you're looking at just shallow seas and threats in those regions? You're building these large vessels because you want to have, you want to sail in the far seas, which is like you said, what the 2015 Defense White Paper said, right? Overseas interests are important. So that probably tells us a little bit more about where the money is going. And if the money is going in this direction, then the interest in mind is a broader, wider global interest, as opposed to your nearby sort of seas and security with regard to disputed territories in South China Sea or things
like that. We're also looking at amphibious capacities, right? That has also increased in past few years.
And but that can be used for, you know, amphibious capacity can be used within, you know, in your near abroad, in your sort of immediate domain, which is the Southeast China Sea, so on and so forth. But when you're building aircraft carriers and destroyers and spending money on that, it tells you a little bit about where your interest is. Your interest is beyond your immediate periphery.
And similar pattern is seen in Air Force as well.
Yeah.
So they have longer ranged aircraft that are coming up. They have strategic aircraft, stealth aircraft that are coming up, which will show that they have ambition in fire.
Yeah, and in each of these also, what we've not been able to factor in, because we've looked at manufacturing costs, but to factor in also R&D that goes in before the manufacturing. And once you manufacture the sort of electronic upgrades and so on and so forth, which will come into maintenance and subsequently, but the idea that those will also be a long-term expenditure.
Yes.
So when you're building these things, it's not like you've spent the 900 million and it's fine. About 70% of your expense on some of these vessels will come in its entire lifespan going forward.
Yes.
So more money will then probably, once you start seeing that equipment figure going down from 40%, and maybe maintenance and sustenance going up, that'll tell you a little bit about where their manufacturing has plateaued, and now the real cost of maintaining these things will come up.
Also, the personal affair will go up, but that is, yes.
Absolutely.
We have factored that in the later part of. You can go to the document if you want.
Okay, so apart from where they're spending money, what else do we have?
The changes that has happened in their training regimes.
Okay.
So it is a well-known fact that PLA is criticized for not having intensive trainings. Their leadership has over time and again said that we are not ready for a war, because the last war we had was in 1979, which was Vietnam. And in reality, if you talk to any army personnel, actual war experience is different from training. So when she took over, it was said in Hu Jintao's regime as well, but when she took over, first the speech that he gives out in January first week, he over and over says that we need to develop intensive, rigorous training in actual conditions, training in actual combat abilities. And which they are trying to do over past 5 years. For example, they have institutionalized the Blue Force. Blue Force means a replication of US Army. And Red Force means their home army, PLA. Real combat conditions, they make PA Blue Force fight with the Red Force. And over the past few years, since 2014, when they created a permanent force, in fact, the Red Army started losing, which was not happening before. That is one change that has happened. Second time, they brought AI into training in 2017, and that exercises happens every year. This was the second thing that happened. And they have created permanent basis for fighting of blue forces with the red forces. That is the replication of US Army with China's homegrown RPLA. These are in Inner Mongolia region.
So the idea is that, you know, I mean, this is the phrase that's been used frequently, right? That the PLA has a peace disease. And a lot of writing, even in India, about this tends to come up with the fact that, well, they haven't been in combat conditions. So they're, you know, they're untested, which is true. They're untested. And that's why Xi Jinping talks about combat readiness, which, like you said, right? Training in realistic conditions. I mean, I remember we had a couple of Chinese guests visiting us, and when they were talking about training of the PLA, they would talk about things like, You know what, some of these things had become such routine, corrupt practices that, you know, people, these were such choreographed exercises that people knew where they are going to die, where they need to reach at a certain point of time so that you can die and so that the Red Force can win. I mean, this was sort of internal, you know, you save yourself the effort and you also, you know, make your bosses happy by saying, look, the Red Force won, so we will win. But this sort of changes with Xi Jinping emphasizing the fact that, look, we need to be far more realistic about what we are doing. And like you said, institutionalizing a blue force and giving it a certain structure and saying that, look, you need to compete, and in encouraging that level of competition will sort of embolden, you know, strengthen the capacity of the force. I mean, it's very difficult to eventually even test this capacity, because unless they actually fight a war or unless they have some sort of combat role, it's really difficult. But at the moment, PLA has really no combat role altogether.
Also, in our paper, there is an interesting graph which points out that military exercises and drill have gone up from 2014 to 2018, 2019. The data which we have till is 2018-2019, and not only gone up, multiplied in many instances.
Yeah,
and it is both bilateral and multilateral exercises.
Yeah, that's an exponential change that starts to happen, and it starts to happen from around 2014 onwards, right? That they pay far greater attention to sort of working with militaries around the world in order to gain greater experience. Okay, so that's sort of four broad things that we've talked about. There are many other things in the document itself, such as what they've done to deal with so if you're letting people go, you're also creating more veterans. From what I understand, there are already about 57 million PLA veterans that are there in China. And you need to give these people jobs. You need to make sure that they're rehabilitated in society.
Pensions.
So all of those things are going to impact. And Xi Jinping therefore set up a new Veterans Affairs Ministry, which is going to deal with some of these things, and also hike pension pays over a period of time, which will reflect over a period of time now. So that's another thing that they've done. And there are many sort of other sort of aspects that we looked at. There are seven broad classifications that we've come up with regard to these reforms. And then we eventually looked at how these are furthering national security objectives. When it comes to these objectives, we essentially looked at the speeches that Suyash spoke about, along with looking at actually what the white paper is saying. And also from the point of view of what seems to be a revealed preference, right? So if you're developing a destroyer and you're saying, I want to protect my homeland, that really makes no sense. You're looking further abroad, therefore. So I think we looked at some of these things and we came up with an assessment of what we believe has happened in terms of how these reforms have impacted broadly China's national security objectives. And there are three broad conclusions that we have. There are also individual assessments with regard to each national security objective. But the three broad conclusions I'd like to just sort of share with you. The first is that we believe that the Chinese are much more comfortable in terms of their homeland security, in terms of the territorial security that they have. And therefore, you're looking to project power overseas. The second is that the PLA has a greater ability to contain domestic turmoil and project power in disputed territories. Therefore, you're seeing much more action in South China Sea. But the cost of using force, particularly when it comes to Taiwan, and this is where I was talking about the political cost of some of these things, because force is an instrument, and you, however sharp and however strong, there is a political cost associated with some of these actions. And that political cost still remains extremely high, whether it comes to using force with regard to Taiwan, whether it comes to using force, overt force in South China Sea or on the border with India to use that force. And finally, while these sort of drills and changes in even military education, and Suyash will tell you that we've categorized also what sort of educational changes have happened in terms of total overall military education, all of these have done multiple things, but most importantly, they've sort of strengthened political control. Yet the combat readiness, like we said, is untested, and there's very little sort of means to test it unless you actually see combat. Suresh, anything else to sort of add in terms of what people can expect in terms of the document, and what can they expect when we go forward with this research?
The broad trends will remain same till something significant is happening in China. Coronavirus can be an outlier to this, but the broad trend will remain same for the next few years, and we can just update it by what modernization is happening and whether they are going towards their stated goal. So their stated goal was by 2020 mechanization, 2035 informatization, and 2050
to become a world-class army. Yeah.
China is not there yet, but at least it is walking on a track to achieve it. There can be multiple outliers to this, and years will tell forward, but at least it is walking on the track to achieve.
All right. So with that, thank you so much for listening to us. What we'll try and do is try and share the document within the show notes, along with some of the other reference material that exists in terms of books. And if you're interested, so do let us know what you thought about the document and share your feedback with us. Suyash can be found on Twitter. Suyash, can you share your handle?
My handle is Suyash_Desai. Suyash_Desai.
And I'm @thechinadude. Thank you so much for listening to us.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.